Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for December 18th, 2011. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a long overdue newscast in which I discuss several stories that caught my attention over the past couple of weeks, including the fact that OpenDNS is adding encryption to its free services, a proof-of-concept chip constructed from a material that's novel at least to computing molybdenite may promise smaller, lower-energy chips, 3D printing in space, and Sony is apparently off the hook for killing Linux as an alternate boot option on its PlayStation 3. All of this and more. First, though, I do want to let you know that this is likely to be the last show of 2011. Next Sunday is, of course, Christmas for those who observe. I personally do not, and left to my own devices, would just enjoy the day off. But all of my in-laws who are in town here, local, do observe, which means I am pretty much obligated to participate in all the family festivities, and that's just not going to leave time to do production next weekend. The Sunday after that is New Year's Day, and I'm likely to be in need of a bit of recovery time. It's looking like we may be gathering with some friends, and while it may not be the most raucous off-the-hook party, it promises to be a lot of fun and a good chance to catch up with folks that are very dear to us. I do have the whole week off between the two holidays, so it isn't outside the realm of possibility that I may have the time and desire to write out a feature cast and record it. But given how hard I've been working since taking my new job back in March, back in the spring of this year, I would say the odds are pretty low that really I do want to enjoy the lengthy time off that I have. But we'll just see. I might get the itch to do it. If you do want to hear more from me, there are several ways that you can do so. That's the good news. There's a new episode of the Living Proof Brewcast that I just released that last Saturday. A really good discussion, part one of two, around some beers from New Mexico and surrounding areas. I also guest co-hosted another episode of Technorama last week. I'll include links to that as well as a Living Proof in the show notes. And you can also check out all 5 days of travelogues from my most recent business trip to Paris. So if you're interested in a tech geek, food geek, beer geek's impressions, first honest impressions of visiting the city, never having been there before, and you don't mind the raw audio quality and the somewhat rambly nature of that discussion, feel free to check those out. I'll include links to all 5 days in the show notes as well. Lastly, listener Florian sent me an article that I think is particularly timely given the time of year that we're dealing with shorter days, with more darkness, less light. This is in particular on ways to hack your metabolism, hopefully safely, to overcome the factors that often lead to seasonal mood issues. This is something that actually dovetails with thoughts that I often have around this time of year, not necessarily dealing with a seasonal affective or other kinds of mood issues, but just I think the relationship between celebratory lights, displays that involve a lot of light, and why they're appropriate, regardless of whatever denomination you happen to be from, if any at all. So I encourage you to check that out, and as with all of the other things that I mentioned, I'll include a link to that blog posting in the show notes. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. David Strom at Read Write Web was one of several folks to cover the announcement from OpenDNS of the launch of a new security tool. Dubbed DNS Crypt, it does for the lookup of internet names what SSL has been doing for web traffic. Namely, adding encryption to make a whole class of attacks that much harder to pull off. If you're unfamiliar with OpenDNS, they provide a variety of free name resolution services. It's actually the domain name system that I tend to prefer on systems where I'm allowed and it's safe to do so. I actually set that up as the primary resolvers, as I happen to like that service and a lot of things that they layer on top of that. Traditionally, they've offered many other tools to help manage networks when it comes to this particular class of internet service. Strom has some good explanations of why what OpenDNS has added to their tooling is important, namely that interfering with name resolution is key to several kinds of spoofing and man-in-the-middle attacks, all of which have become increasingly popular as more sites are, in fact, deploying SSL by default, making other kinds of attacks less feasible. DNS Crypt is not the only answer in this space. Strom mentions DNSSEC, very much worth pointing to as well. Unlike that older effort, all DNS Crypt does is secure traffic to and from the name servers, in this instance, initially hosted by OpenDNS, and hopefully, as this is being open sourced, eventually others. They are releasing the source code soon, both for the improved scrutiny that comes of having that source available, the notion expressed by others of many eyes make all bugs shallow, but also so that other name service providers can adopt and use it. DNSSEC, by comparison, deals with issues of trusting the answers that are given by name servers as much as actually securing the traffic between clients and servers. When more widely adopted, it could help deal with the trust issues that I've talked about repeatedly that seem to be increasingly cropping up with SSL as a consequence of the points of failure in the whole public key infrastructure system, that is, in particular, these certificate authorities. DNSSEC is much more involved to deploy, however. DNS Crypt could then be a shorter-term complementary offering such that overall, the combination of the two would really help protect users on a variety of fronts, and DNS Crypt in particular would help bridge until those deeper solutions are more commonly available. Right now, DNS Crypt is only available for the Mac and is labeled as early release quality, so use with that adviso in mind. Improvements and clients for Windows and Linux are promised soon, however, so hopefully this will evolve rapidly to the betterment of everybody. There are certain programs I consider to be go-to ones that I use regardless of circumstance, or even in some cases, even operating system. When I have to work on a Windows machine for any length of time, PuTTY is definitely one of those programs. It's a small and capable SSH client exclusively for Windows, and from the same download site where you acquire it, there are all the other usual battery of tools that you use with SSH available as well, equally small and as well crafted. Unlike Linux and even OS X, there isn't really a standard distribution of an SSH client for Windows. It doesn't come bundled in the same way. Maybe that's a consequence of the lengths to which Microsoft goes to hide the command line, or that you really need a virtual network connection, a VNC, or remote desktop protocol, RDP client, with that full graphical interaction to actually administer Windows boxes. This ignores the fact that many people work in heterogeneous environments. For any number of purposes, SSH is an excellent secure means to access and work on servers. It would be useful if Windows would include a client for it as well, even if that's not the appropriate tool for interacting with a Windows-based server. I've been known to just keep PuTTY on a Windows-formatted thumb drive when I'm in an environment, even among friends and family, where Windows is prevalent. PuTTY is open source, licensed under the permissive MIT license, so you not only can use it however you need to use it, but should feel free to share it as widely as possible among your Windows-using friends and acquaintances. The H's security channel reminded me that PuTTY is still very actively being maintained. This week, author Simon Tatham released an update that closed a critical security hole. Older versions of the software prior to 0.62 kept passwords in memory, where it's possible malicious programs could read them, or they might get swapped to file or dumped to a crash file on disk where they could also be read. The article lists several other fixes that make it clear that Tatham does a far more than just fix critical security flaws, but is actively working to keep the program current and stable. If you use PuTTY like I do, make sure you update to the new version 0.62. I can also recommend what I mentioned in describing PuTTY, the additional lightweight tools that he maintains alongside the primary client, in particular for secure remote copying through SSH and through a secure FTP, and to provide an SSH agent for Windows that makes key-based authentication so much more convenient, this in the form of a little tool called Pageant. All of these easily fit on a thumb drive and can be launched from one as well, making them perfect for family tech support so you can always access one of your own servers, regardless of what environment you find yourself in. Here are the news stories that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website at thecommandline.net. The BBC was one of several sources to cover new research from the Laboratory of Nanoscale Electronics and Structures, LANES, in Lausanne. The team there, led by Professor Andras Kies, has been working on a prototype microchip utilizing molybdenite in place of silicon. This material, a naturally occurring mineral compound of molybdenum and silicon, has a laundry list of properties that sound almost unbelievable. It's already used for a variety of commercial and industrial applications, so is fairly easily accessible for new uses like this one. Being far less reactive, less prone to oxidization than silicon, it can be used in much thinner layers in the fabrication process. By comparison, the thinnest at which silicon is useful for computing is about 2 nanometers. Molybdenite can be utilized in structures just 3 molecules thick. The decrease in volume of material yields an extra benefit in a proportional reduction in power needed to drive a circuit and the attendant lowering of waste heat produced. Molybdenite is as stiff as stainless steel, yet in the forms used here can easily be molded and flexed. The smaller amount of material required combined with this flexibility makes it feasible for circuitry that can be contorted into useful shapes or even rolled up in the recent science fictional trope that we've seen in films of a roll-up or roll-out display. The work here is more than theoretical, though at the very early stages. The researchers used a technique that sounds very similar to one deployed to produce sheets of graphene, another material being explored to replace silicon in chips. A sheet of sticky material, perhaps like cellophane tape, is applied to a molybdenite crystal. Pulling this away results in a thin layer of the material coming with it. The sheet is then deposited on a support structure and the adhesive removed. A simple prototype circuit has been built in this fashion. Attached to 6 serial transistors, it was demonstrated performing basic logic functions. In addition to all of the benefits of this material, it has one advantage over its closest competitor, graphene. Circuits built from graphene have to be cooled to the range of liquid nitrogen, while molybdenite will operate at room temperature, just like silicon. The article doesn't mention if molybdenite suffers from the energy gap problem identified in graphene, where a transistor made from that carbon-based material can't be turned off completely, making it, at least at this time, less than ideal for switching purposes, electronic switching purposes. This limit in how the carbon-based material performs as I said, an electrical switch, may ultimately limit its performance in computers and the field of applications to which it can be applied. The article does conclude with remarks from the researchers saying that commercial use is somewhere between 10 to 20 years off for molybdenite-based chips without any explanation really as to why. There's a mention of future work to make it more conductive, hinting that there are drawbacks in its electrical characteristics, offsetting its almost too good to be true physical characteristics. Research into graphene has a head start in terms of fabrication methods that are more likely to scale. Less labor-intensive means will have to be developed than the sticky film approach here for molybdenite. Perhaps that is also a barrier to the near-term work, being able to produce sheets in useful enough quantities to work on the other challenges mentioned. I wonder about the possibility of mixing materials to include the strengths of them all, in much the same way some researchers looking at many-core chips where each processor in the die does something more specialized, rather than having a homogeneous many-core system where all of the computing cores are identical and hence maybe not quite as useful in the aggregate. With no clear hands-down successor to silicon, at least today, maybe a transitional approach would be to mix and match until the research advances enough to produce something simpler that takes us further beyond the limits where we are facing today with traditional chips. I found this next piece through Slashdot, where Paul Miller, writing at the relatively new tech news site The Verge, has a novel, if not also interesting, take on criticizing modern UIs. We can argue about what makes for good interaction design, invoking Jacob Nielsen and others, all under that field of human-computer interfaces. The proposals that they've advanced, a more formal basis for how users can and should interact with computers. It rarely makes a difference, I think, in the experience most of us have, at least in interacting with the latest crop of commercial operating systems. I call attention to this aspect of his critique because all of his examples, all of the complaints he levels are at OS X or Windows. In a word, he has finally identified these issues, even if they're narrowly focused, as the word he uses is condescending. After untold years of feeling a sort of diffuse, unnamed irritation with him, he's actually finally apparently put his finger on it, and I have to agree with a large part of his argument. He does a good job of explaining what he means, that the convenience meant to make digital interactions easier soon become the source of unending annoyance. He compares whiz-bang animations, guided interactions, and subtle visual cues to your car, explaining to you every knob and lever when you sit in it. To drive his point home, he asks that you imagine it does this every single time that you get in to drive, insisting in a brain-damaged fashion that you always need the same level of hand-holding as the very first time when it's actually convenient that you interacted with such a complicated bit of machinery. There are counterexamples he doesn't explore, though they aren't found in mainstream computing. Video games increasingly have explored training wheel models with good success. Long gone are the days you bought a game and had to pore through a manual before actually starting play. The most obvious technique they use are tutorial levels and minigames. Once you feel like you've gotten the game's rules and its underlying mechanics, you can usually escape these sort of shepherded exercises, leaving them behind permanently, or when you need a refresher, re-invoking them, re-entering them as needed. I've played some games where the UI itself carries some slowly self-shed hints as to how various controls and mechanisms work. In many ways, they're comparable to what he finds so annoying, but they're not as persistent. They're designed to fall away, hence me likening them to training wheels. Undoubtedly, game designers get that players have a limited stock of patience. They don't want to exhaust it early on. At some point, each player reaches a point where they just want to get on with the fun. I think this mode of thinking could address much of Miller's complaints. Is it the fact that modern commercial computers are sold to both individuals and businesses still that keeps them from mimicking what works so well in the equally lucrative video game market? The term and process of gamification has certainly been cropping up a lot recently, due in no small part to the work of innovative thinkers like Jane McGonigal. Certainly that lends the suggestion some credibility, I would hope, that if a business project or practice can be made more efficient, effective, and rewarding through adopting gaming elements, there is good cause to hope that the condescension with which I agree we are treated by our computers could largely be offset, if not mostly eliminated, by adopting similar practices. The other thought I had, of course, to which I've already alluded, is that if you used a free operating system, in my experience, they offer a greater degree of customization. Even if you cannot tweak the more popular desktop environments entirely to your liking, you can certainly install some alternate ones, even ones as severe as Rat Poison, which eliminates overlapping windows, and the usual Chrome decorating applications, so you really can take that minimalist approach to its logical conclusion. The cost, of course, with these is the associated learning curve and the time investment involved to actually do those customizations. I suspect, though, that if you agree with Miller about how condescending you find operating systems like Windows and OS tend to be, you won't mind a little bit of research and learning whose biggest dividend is having exactly the interaction environment you want without sacrificing all the capabilities of a modern, powerful operating system. Andy Bayo at waxy.org shared an interesting trend he identified on YouTube. He offers a single example of a person on YouTube uploading a remixed version of the film Pulp Fiction that simply puts the scenes in it into their proper chronological order. The interesting bit is the added disclaimer that the uploader intended no infringement. Bayo digs into this a bit further, offering evidence that some sort of disclaimer along these lines is a surprisingly common occurrence on the video sharing site. He speculates that the practice is most common among the youngest account holders. There are even discussions in YouTube's own support forums evincing confusion over videos that are blocked or have had parts like the soundtrack stripped out, despite this explicit statement that no infringement was meant. Post asks after the correct way to word these disclaimers without fully realizing that most of the takedowns are fully automated, that there's nobody actually to read a case somebody makes for fair use and to perhaps leave a remix of this nature unmolested. There have been many discussions of the norms of sharing and remix online as contrasted to what the laws on the books actually say is allowed and disallowed. Bayo's post provides some solid evidence of this gap between common practice and what is and is not allowed under the actual statutes. He offers a couple of conclusions. The first is that the oldest of those uploading with these disclaimers will soon be of an age where they can vote. He doesn't mention SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, but with all the attention the discussion of that bill has been getting, the implication is that what has formerly not been a voting issue may become so in much less than a single generation. At the very least, we may see a fresh crop of copyright activists, not motivated by abstract arguments about cultural production and common heritage, but rather by the direct consequences of the content industry's attempts to pass laws that abruptly chop off what the youngest generation of net users find to be perfectly normal and even may consider to be fair. To be perfectly clear, I'm not talking about commercial piracy. I never do when defending normative social behavior against laws that are simply out of touch. Bayo makes perfectly clear that what drives the perception of allowed use is the intention of remixing and sharing without commercial gain, and an attempt at proper attribution to the original rights holder. The first commenter on Bayo's post actually makes an interesting point that to the set being described, those undertaking these activities on the video sharing site, the copyright symbol, the C in a circle, may be understood by them as an attribution mark, not as copyright as it is currently legally framed. The other point Bayo makes, based on these observations, is how similar this gap is to the laws and behaviors under prohibition. I respectfully disagree, if just a little bit, as I explained in my recent digital scofflaws discussion on this very podcast with Chris Miller. When distribution and serving of alcohol was forbidden, I would argue that those breaking the law knew full well what they were doing. As Bayo so perfectly illustrates, the purported scofflaws here are largely ignorant of the law. The circumstances are hard to compare, as copyright law has always been fairly complex compared to a simple ban on an easily identified class of commercial goods, that is, booze. The weight of the commercial lobby also differs. Under prohibition, those dealing in liquors were just as affected as consumers. Those pushing the laws did so not for reasons of money, but for moral principles. These were the Anti-Saloon League and the teetotalers. One could argue that the tech companies may have a similar role in the copy fight, but so far, the giants like Google, Twitter, and Facebook have not seen increasingly draconian enforcement laws as the same existential threat as prohibition to brewers, distillers, and distributors. Again, with the attention SOPA is drawing, that may be changing, but it doesn't alter that there is an immense amount of cash and an equally deep reserve of media and political savvy backing copyright maximalism. Regardless, I'm happy that as high-profile a blogger as Andy is helping to keep this discussion alive, especially when he is able to bring to light some excellent facts backing his points. Slashdot linked to a story, the idea within which that, on reflection, really makes a great deal of sense. Innovation News Daily highlighted a startup working to bring 3D printing into space. And this is not like the what a lot of the maker and hacker spaces are doing with their kind of homebrew space initiatives. This is bringing it into space in a very commercial and a very big way. Made in Space was recently selected by NASA to explore this idea. The biggest constraint at present in space exploration and industry is the cost, per kilogram it takes to lift a set amount of mass into orbit. When dealing with long-duration missions, as with the International Space Station mentioned in the article, this is an excellent example of a first application. You really can't always plan what will be needed logistically for maintenance and repair over such long amounts of time. You would still need to lift feedstock when dealing with additive fabrication like this, but you wouldn't need to know ahead of time what particular parts, tools, or supplies you would need. You could just dial in a raw bulk amount over time just to top things up. You would just essentially need to keep the raw materials well supplied. That could be more easily predicted and I think made more cost effective over time. To deal with ongoing needs, all you'd have to do is transmit design files, and whatever is required would just draw off from a ready supply of material. Made in Space has very ambitious plans that put it in the realm of small-scale commercial 3D printing rather than homebrew systems about which I usually talk and write. They have a near-term goal of being able to print the parts and tools needed to construct small unmanned spacecraft like CubeSats or cubic satellites. If they are able, or have been able, to license some of the more advanced patents in this space of additive fabrication, odds are good they'll be able to work at the bleeding edge, especially printing mixed materials at the same time. I recently heard a Big Ideas talk from the CBC series of that name, from Hod Lipson, about programmable matter, where he articulated this idea of printing a robot that could walk out of the printer. Made in Space's idea of printing spacecraft sounded very similar to me, and puts them in good company in terms of not just pushing into a novel field of use, but also working hard to advance the state of 3D printing overall. Right now, they are working on some basic challenges presented by microgravity. When you think about it, this is the natural place to start. Both powder bed and extrusion-based printers rely on full gravity to work the way they do. Made in Space has been taking their printer prototypes up on the Vomit Comet. You may have heard of this. This is a large cargo plane that flies a parabolic course. So as it's coming down from the very peak that it flies up to, the plane and everything in it experiences free fall. So far, using this platform, this much more cost-effective, though still somewhat costly way of simulating microgravity, they've succeeded in printing their very first tool, a small wrench. The immediate focus will be on certifying their technology and the necessary feedstock for use in microgravity before continuing on to scaling up and improving it. In thinking about these early obstacles, I also wonder if there are opportunities. Could a 3D printer do things in microgravity that isn't possible in normal conditions? I know from talks I've attended that producing parts with voids in them can be a challenge, as the hot plastics will collapse if not timed and handled correctly, or it requires use of mixed materials, which isn't always as accessible for the cheaper end of this market. In the absence of gravity, is that less of a limiter? Can you make shapes with cavities for wires and socketed parts, for instance, that don't collapse while the material is still soft because there's nothing acting strongly against its own mass? If Made in Space is successful, undoubtedly we'll find out. Better yet, I hope that we see commercial ventures like those sparked by the XPRIZE consider also adopting the technology for the benefits being explored by Made in Space. That would multiply the odds of us identifying the obvious and the counterintuitive advantages to be had by including 3D printers and feedstock as standard space gear. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've discussed before. I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. Helicon Valley, the technology blog at the DC local blog The Hill, had news of two of the strongest opponents to the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA, having introduced a competing bill designed to address some of the concerns raised by the very controversial SOPA. The main difference is the Open Act, as it's being called, drops the controversial domain name blocking and leaves just the actions against payment processors and ad networks. The way in which this bill has been put forward is also quite different, as Mike Masnick at TechDirt explains. Rather than just releasing a PDF version that contains scans of the text that cannot be cut and pasted for the purposes of commentary, the sponsors have launched a website to house discussion and put out an open call for feedback. Unfortunately, the hearing on SOPA this past week has drowned out much of the attention this bill might have gathered. I actually had a special follow-up post of links this week up on the website just of SOPA stories leading up to, around, and following on from that hearing on midweek. Eric Goldman, a tech law blogger, had a guest post on Ars Technica where he shared some concerns about this new bill. As much as it addresses some of the complaints, basically, it shares several of the flawed assumptions around dealing with foreign websites. Goldman is not optimistic that it is a real improvement on SOPA and the Protect IP Act, the Senate equivalent of SOPA, but does credit it as a useful prod for discussion of the underlying assumptions and how the laws are framed, in particular, whether they are too broad and how to narrow them appropriately. Caleb Cox at the Register had news that the effort to hold Sony accountable for dropping the other OS boot option from later versions of the PS3 firmware in the form of a class action suit has been dismissed in a federal district court. The judge seemed sympathetic to the complaint, but simply didn't feel there were enough facts to make complaints under computer fraud, unfair competition, or breach of warranty stick. It isn't clear if this can be appealed, whether such a dismissal, the way that this was turned down, prevents that, or the Federal Circuit usually accepts appeals on class actions. I just don't know enough about how the judicial system works to say. I doubt this will affect the hardware hacking community, though, that they will continue to seek and find ways to jailbreak the device so they can experiment both with legitimate and illegitimate uses. This was actually, I think, what prodded Sony in the first place to drop this alternate boot system, something they advertised very early on and attracted quite a bit of good positive attention, especially from the academic community. Most famously, I believe it actually was a military supercomputer that was built out of a cluster, a Beowulf cluster of PlayStation 3s, this commodity, fairly beefy processing nodes. My own children are of an age where their friends have either PlayStation 3s or Xbox 360s. As much as I also despise Microsoft, I make no secret of that, I'm leaning towards eventually caving to getting them whatever the next Xbox is. And the reasons for caving really are more social, that as a lot of the gameplay and social interaction goes online, this is the kind of residential gateway device that apparently their generation is doing it through. I'm unlikely to ever willingly purchase another Sony consumer electronics product based not just on the outcome of this complaint, as much as it's bitterly disappointing, but really as much as it's a further data point in a pattern of behavior that could be seen, I think, as abuse of consumer interests. That's going to do it for this episode, and as I mentioned in the intro, most likely for 2011. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next episode will be a feature cast, not sure on the topic yet. Most likely, as I said again in the intro, it's going to be in a brand spanking new year, 2012. Very slim odds you might hear it between now and then over the break. Either way, until you hear from me next, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, Permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.